please raise your hands if you cannot hear me. Well, since no hands are raised, I guess everything is okay. No matter where I stand, some of you won't be able to see me. Please raise your hands if you cannot see me. Anyway, I'll stand around here. So if you want to be able to see me, then, and you can't, then so you might want to move. And if you move to a place where you can see me now, that should keep working. 21 years ago, I launched the free software movement and announced I planned to develop a free software operating system compatible with Unix with the name of GNU. Free software doesn't mean zero price. It doesn't mean gratis. It means that the users have certain essential freedoms, which I, over years, later years, worked out precisely. Freedom zero is the freedom, a program is free software if you have these four freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you see fit. Freedom one is the freedom to help yourself, the freedom to study the source code of the program and change it as you see fit. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to distribute copies to others. And freedom three is the freedom to help build your community, the freedom to publish modified versions so others can get the benefit of your contribution. All of these four freedoms are necessary so that the users of the software can live an ethical life where they help their neighbors, and so that they can individually and collectively have control over their own computers. To have control over your computer, you've got to be able to change the software to do what you want. But it would be hopeless for you to do that alone without anyone else's help. Because the job would be too big for any person, whether programmers or non-programmers, merely being able to change it yourself is not enough. We've got to be able to work together in order to make the software do what we want. In the 1990s, the GNU system became usable. The last missing piece was filled in by the kernel Linux in 1992. And so as people got more interested in GNU and free software, and I started to give more speeches about free software, I found that after the speeches, people would sometimes ask me whether these same ideas apply to other things. Well, often they would be silly. They would say, well, what about free hardware? Should hardware be free too? The question actually doesn't make much sense. Remember, free software means software for which you have these four freedoms. So let's see, what would it mean for hardware to be free? Well, what would it mean for that chair to be free? It would mean, first of all, that you're free to copy it. So if you've got a chair copier, you're free to use it. But there are no chair copiers. In fact, there basically aren't copiers for physical objects. So that's basically a meaningless question. And then, you know, are you free to run it? Well, yeah. If you bought the chair, you're free to use it as you like. And free to study it and change it. Well, there is no source code for a chair. Chairs don't come out of compilers. But you are free to study the chair and change it. If you buy a wooden chair, you could even chop it up and use it for firewood. And basically, no one's going to interfere. No one's going to claim that he has a monopoly on changing that chair. And, yeah, copying and distributing copies to others, well, since there are no copiers, you might as well be free. You can do it as well as if you were free, so it doesn't matter. And publishing a modified version, well, again, that doesn't really make sense unless you can copy it. Yeah, you can modify it, but that only gives you one. The only way to get more is to build them, because there are no copiers. So the question, should hardware be free? for this sense of the word free is not a meaningful question. But the question does make sense for other kinds of works, other kinds of things that you could have in a file on your computer. Those things, yes, you are capable of copying and distributing and changing and using. So the question of whether you're allowed to do that becomes a meaningful question. Now, the answer doesn't have to be the same in all of these cases, but the question makes sense for all kinds of works that you might have on your computer. For anything other than software, practically speaking, the only thing that's likely to stop you from doing what you want with some work that's on your computer is copyright law. So, practically speaking, this question is the question of what copyright law ought to say. What should copyright law permit you to do, permit everyone to do? Now, therefore, this question becomes tied up with copyright law. And in order to think about copyright law, we have to think about how copyright law evolved to its current state. And the history of copyright law is connected with the history of copying technology. Changes in technology can't alter basic moral principles. Those are too deep to be reached by something as superficial as a change in technology. But when we apply principles to make judgments about any specific question, we always look at the consequences of the various choices. And the consequences of the choices are affected by the context. A change in the context can alter the consequences of a particular choice and make it better or worse. You know, to pick an extreme example, whether it's good or bad for me to shoot you depends on whether I know you're wearing a bulletproof vest. And so, changes in copying technology have altered the consequences of copyright law as it was, and alter the ethical issues of copyright law today. But I should start the history at the beginning, in the ancient world, because copying of books began in the ancient world. At that time, copying was done in most parts of the world with a pen and ink. So you would sit down and read a book and you would write the same words. Now, this technology had certain consequences. First of all, anyone who could read and write could copy a book about as well as anyone else who could read and write. It's true if you spent all your time copying books, then you'd get faster at it and better at it somewhat. But, you know, you wouldn't have to copy for too long before you learned to do it reasonably well. And as a result, and the other thing was, to make 10 identical copies took 10 times as long as making one copy. So there was no inherent economy of scale in copying with a pen and ink. Another consequence of this technology was that it was decentralized. Because anyone who could read could copy. Copies could be made anywhere. Another consequence was that copying didn't have to be exact. In fact, the ancient world had the concept of an author. They understood that a certain play was written by Sophocles, say. But in between writing a book and copying a book, there were other useful things that you could do. For instance, you could start copying a book, but then you could write some new text, and then you could continue copying and write some more new text, and so on. That was writing a commentary, and it was a respected, useful thing to do. You could also write some new text and then copy part of a book, and then write some more new text and copy part of another book, and so on. This was making a compendium, and it was also a respected, useful thing to do. There were ancient works that are lost, but larger or smaller parts of them survived, where they were quoted at length in other books that had better fortune. As far as I can tell, there was nothing like copyright in the ancient world. If you had a copy of a book, you had a right to copy it. However, the printing press later improved copying technology, making copying more efficient, but not uniformly more efficient. It didn't make all copying more efficient. It made one kind of copying more efficient, which was making many copies that were identical. Because it took a lot of work to set the type. But once you had set the type, you could then quickly make many identical sheets. Also, the printing press was, and especially the type, was specialized equipment that hardly, a tiny fraction of people had. So the result of these two things was that copying became centralized. Efficient copying, that is, became centralized. It was done at these comparatively small number of places where there were printing presses and in large quantity. And then the books were transported to where people wanted to buy them. In the first few centuries of printing, a substantial fraction of book copies were still made by hand. This was done for two reasons. One, some rich people wanted to show off how rich they were, and the other, some poor people couldn't afford to buy a printed book, but they did have the time to write a copy. As the song goes, time ain't money when all you got is time. But most copies were made on the printing press. As far as I can tell, copyright began around a little while after the printing press was used in Europe. The earliest reference I've seen to copyright is from Italy in the 1500s. Apparently, at that time, the author of a book could ask a prince to give him a monopoly on printing that book. Princes like to give out monopolies on all sorts of things as a way of rewarding whoever they thought it was nice to reward. And so they sometimes did this too. But it was not automatic. And I suppose they might conceivably have given somebody who wasn't the author a monopoly on printing the book, just as they might have just forbidden printing certain books when they didn't like them. Copyright, as it began in England in the 1500s, was an arrangement between the printers and the king, as I understand it. The publisher had the copyright, assuming that the king had agreed to the publication of the book. In the 1600s, this censorship was removed for a while and then reimposed in a different way. And eventually, in the early 1700s, they adopted a system of giving copyrights to authors instead. When the United States was founded and its constitution was drawn up, there was a proposal that authors should be entitled to a copyright. This proposal was rejected. You'd never guess that from hearing what publishers and their pet authors say nowadays. But the fact is, the U.S. Constitution rejects the idea of copyright as an entitlement. Instead, it says the following: Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by reserving to authors and inventors for a limited time the exclusive use of their respective writings and inventions. So copyright, is, according to the Constitution, is to promote the progress of science. So this doesn't say that, Congress must establish such a system, only that it has the power to do so. So it's an option. It's not required. But it is stated that the purpose of any such system is to promote progress. In other words, it's an artificial incentive to modify certain people's behavior in a way that serves the public interest. Now, copyright in the age of the printing press was essentially an industrial regulation. It was a restriction imposed on publishers for the sake of authors. Well, not real. Actually, I just misspoke. It's a common error. Not for the sake of authors, but to manipulate the behavior of authors, but in the name of the authors. The authors were given this power over publishers. But the crucial thing was, it only restricted publishers. It was an industrial regulation because it didn't restrict what ordinary readers could do. In fact, copyright in the US at that time didn't cover copying per se, it covered publishing. People, poor, especially poor people, continued occasionally to copy books by hand, but nobody ever tried to attack them with copyright law, because people understood it was supposed to be an industrial regulation. And because of this, copyright law was fairly painless, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial. It was fairly painless because it didn't restrict what ordinary citizens could do. It was easy to enforce because it was enforced only against publishers, and it's easy to find who's publishing a book. Go look and see who's selling it and see where they got it, and then you find out who's publishing it. You don't have to invade everyone's home or everyone's computer to enforce copyright against publishers. And it was arguably beneficial because the public had given up a freedom it couldn't exercise anyway as part of a deal for something beneficial. The philosophy of copyright in the US and also, I believe, in other English-speaking countries is that copyright is a deal between the public and authors, and its purpose is to get the public certain benefits of more books being written, which means more books available for you to read and more conversation of ideas that helps the public think about what to do. So if you trade away something of no value to you, and in exchange you get something that does have value, that has to be a good deal. You can't lose anything that way. In the age of the printing press, for ordinary citizens who didn't own printing presses, to give up the freedom to make and publish a book was nothing. They couldn't really do it anyway. They couldn't copy except with pen and ink, and nobody bothered them when they did that. Now, around 1900, printing presses got more efficient. The price of printed books came down, and even poor people stopped copying by hand, for the most part. And eventually people forgot that that was that had been still frequent. But copyright remained an industrial regulation. However, the age of the printing press is giving way to the age of the computer networks, a new improvement in the efficiency of copying technology. And like the previous improvement, this one is not uniform. In fact, its non-uniformity is essentially the opposite of the previous non-uniformity. Whereas where the printing press made one kind of copying a lot more efficient, which was centralized mass production copying only, the computer networks bring up the other kinds. So now, once again, it's more or less uniform. Not completely. It's true that mass-produced CDs cost less than one-off CDs. But it's not, well, one-off CDs are cheap enough that lots of people in the developed world can afford to make them. And the equipment that you need to make copies is no longer something that's rather rare that only a few specialized businesses have invested in. Instead, it's a personal computer, something that hundreds of millions of people in the developed world have. So, we're back to a situation more like the ancient world, where whoever can read or use something can also copy it. And these copies are just as good as any copies you might hope to find anywhere. In fact, they're normally perfect copies, unless your CD burner didn't work right. So, we're in a situation where the freedom that we have traded away as part of the copyright bargain has now become valuable to us. We agreed to trade it away without complaining because we couldn't use it. It was of no value. Why would anyone resist giving up something of no value? But now we can exercise that freedom. Now we can copy. And the result is that you're seeing that copyright law has become controversial. You see, copyright law fit with the printing press technology and doesn't fit with computer network technology, with computer technology at all. The publishers have been recognizing this since the 70s. And in a statement that shows their bias, they like to say that, they often said that computer technology creates problems for copyright, which shows what they think is important and what they think is not important. I'd rather say that copyright creates problems for computer technology, because there's nothing sacred about copyright. It's simply a deal that the public made with authors at a time when that deal was favorable to the public. Now, the nature of computer technology, of digital information technology, is to make it easier to copy and manipulate information. And the problem is that not everybody wants you to be able to do that. So what do you do if you have been in the habit of trading away some useless byproduct that you produce in your life in exchange for something that you like, and then you develop a use for that byproduct so it's no longer worthless? What do? You renegotiate the deal. You say, well, maybe I won't sell all of this anymore. Maybe I'll sell this much, but part of this I'm going to keep. That's what our governments would do on our behalf if they were democratic. And the fact that they are not doing so illustrates how non-democratic they have become. We have seen a technological change, which means that the deal we used to make that used to be good is now harmful. It now takes away a freedom that tens of millions of people are trying to exercise anyway. So the natural thing to do is retain some of that freedom and exercise it. If governments were trying to serve the public interest with copyright, as they're supposed to, then they would be reducing copyright power so as to leave some additional freedom for the public at large. Instead, they're doing just the opposite. even copyright law, as the law was in the age of the printing press, would be too restrictive today. But they're making it even more restrictive. One thing that they're doing is extending the term of copyright. Now, copyright lasts a very long time. Under present-day copyright law, it's easy for a book written by an author who lives a long time to be in copyright for 150 years. In general, nobody alive today can expect to see the books written today go out of copyright, most of them. But the publishers are not satisfied. They want it to be even longer. But it's generally supposed to be the case that copyright lasts only a finite amount of time. And the U.S. Constitution explicitly says it must be a limited time. So they can't get a law that explicitly says copyright is perpetual. Therefore, they have adopted a strategy which achieves the same result, but doesn't honestly admit it. Perpetual copyright on the installment plan. Every 20 years, they retroactively extend copyright by 20 more years. So for any given work, there's a certain date when it's supposed to go into the public domain. But don't expect to reach that date, because by the time you get there, it'll move away from you. Every 20 years, they'll move it back 20 years, and you'll never see anything go into the public domain again. That's what they intend. The U.S. in 1998 extended copyright by 20 years in this way. We call that the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act, because we believe that Disney paid for it. Disney didn't want the copyright on the character Mickey Mouse to expire. Now, they claimed that they thought that a 75-year copyright for a work made for hire, that's a work whose author is a company, not an individual, is an employer, actually, was not enough to be an incentive to develop new works. But they didn't show projected balance sheets for 75 years in the future, which would explain how they wouldn't be making enough money then. And they also extended the copyright for things that were written and produced in the 1920s without showing how that would convince the authors and artists of the 1920s, who were now dead, to increase their writings back then. Perhaps if they had a time machine and they could go back in time to those writers and those artists and say, by the way, we're giving you 20 years of copyright, 20 years more copyright, some of those people would say, gee, yeah, I think I will write that book anyway. I just was thinking about this and decided that that much copyright just isn't enough. It's not worth writing anything. This is, of course, ridiculous. That's not how writers and artists think. So the point is that all they gave to the principles that copyright law is supposed to be based on was lip service. Another dimension, and right now the European Union is being pressured to extend the copyright on musical recordings by some 20 years or so. It's currently 50 years, which means that some of Elvis's music recordings are going to go into the public domain. The record companies don't want that to happen. Their attitude is, if something is profitable for us to sell, it should never go into the public domain. So they're starting the campaign now. And Norway may be facing an EU directive to increase this in a few years. And it will be up to Norway to veto that directive, not participate. because it shouldn't be restricting its citizens for no good reason. That's, you know, how long copyright lasts is one dimension. How wide it is another dimension. Which different uses of a work are regulated by copyright law? You see, copyright law was not supposed to cover all uses of a published work. That was never the idea. There's a space of possible uses, and initially most of them were unregulated uses, and copyright covered some of them. But they've been increasing it and increasing it, and a few years ago they came up with an idea for how to go all the way to make copyright truly restrict everything. And this is, again, it's deceptive, it's indirect. They don't come right out and say, from now on, whatever you do with a copyrighted work, including read it or listen to it, is now restricted by copyright law. Instead, they say they've come up with a kind of law which says that publishers can write their own copyright requirements by writing them in software. Specifically, what they say is that if the publisher publishes something in encrypted form or in some other way blocking access, then distributing software or hardware or any information about how to bypass these restrictions is prohibited. So whatever restrictions and conditions are imposed by the authorized software has the effect of law. It has the force of law. And the publishers get to decide what the law says. So they're coming out right out and admitting, we're just going to let the publishers write copyright law. Except, in order to see that they've admitted that, you have to understand what they're doing. They don't say it in so many words. It used to be that they let the publishers write copyright law by letting them pay the legislators to vote the law. But with this scheme, that isn't necessary anymore. The publishers just write or develop the players. And the player is an add-on to copyright law. Now, I'm sure you're all familiar with the fact that people haven't always gone along with the publisher's plans, because you probably know about Jon Johansson, who participated in developing the free program to play a DVD. The movies on DVDs are encrypted, and the way of decrypting them was initially a secret until a few people in Europe figured it out. And they released a free software package that you could use to watch the film on a DVD. However, this software is now prohibited, censored in the United States, and a couple of years ago, the EU adopted a directive to do the same thing. It's called the EU Copyright Directive, which Norway's government is just about to consider. I'm going to say more about that later. So, for instance, we can see across the board how publishers are trying to take total power. For instance, look at the area of books. At this point, I don't think that the publishers would like to take away from us certain rights that we have always enjoyed, such as the right to borrow a book from the library, buy it from a used bookstore, lend a book to a friend, buy a book anonymously for paying cash, and even to keep a book for as long as we like and keep reading it as many times as we like. These are all things that the publishers would like to forbid. But they can't quite get away with forbidding this for printed books, because there are too many millions of people who appreciate having the freedom to do these things. So instead, they came up with an indirect plan to get to the same result. First, they thought, let's take away these freedoms, not for printed books, but for e-books. And that's what they achieved with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the EUCD, with the prohibition of circumvention. Then the publishers just have to design a player that won't let you do these things, and it's illegal for you to bypass it. Well, they didn't face resistance because there were no e-books. No, the general public didn't know what freedom they were later on not going to have as a result of this. They didn't appreciate it, and they didn't appreciate what they were losing yet. The second stage of this plan is get people to switch from printed books to e-books. They tried that 2 or 3 years ago, and it didn't work. People just didn't switch. I wish I could believe that the reason people didn't switch is that they resented the restrictions on their freedom to use the e-books. But I think it's more likely that it was some purely practical, superficial inconvenience, which means that the publishers will try again. They will try to improve things in some practical way or do something else to overcome the public's reluctance. They will keep trying to make the public agree to give up these freedoms. A place where the threat is more advanced is in recordings of music. Let me read to you what EMI said to their customers in Germany, customers who were complaining about fake CDs. They look like compact discs, but they don't follow the standard for compact discs, and you can't read them the way you read an ordinary compact disc. That's the whole point, to stop you from reading them. If you plan to continue protesting about future audio media releases with copy protection, forget it. Copy protection is a reality, and within a matter of months, more or less, all audio media worldwide are copy protected. And this is a good thing for the music industry. In order to make this happen, we will do anything within our power, whether you like it or not. Now, that's a translation from German, and I'm told that the original is much nastier, but that it's hard to render this in English. So, in response, I say that we should do everything in our power to wipe out those record companies. They don't deserve to exist. They deserve to be abolished. I don't think there's anything wrong with making records and selling them. And it would be nice if we had a copyright system that made the sellers of records pay the musicians. Our present copyright system does not do this. But those record companies only deserve to be abolished. And I hope that you will spread the word to refuse to buy fake CDs. So we can see that there's, on many fronts, we're facing attempts to utilize the laws already passed as a way of taking away the freedoms and practical abilities that we have always had. So what should we do to copyright law if we had democratic governments? What should governments do if they want to show us that they really are democratic and that they are concerned with the interests of their citizens, not with the interests of the large publishers? Well, what we should do is reduce the extent of copyright power. We started in the age of the printing press trading away a certain amount of our freedom because it was useless to us. And now that we want to use it and can use it, we want to keep part of it. So copyright should be scaled back but not necessarily eliminated. But before I make my recommendations, I'd like to say that we don't have to treat all kinds of works the same. The publishers like to ask us, they want us to believe that making any distinctions is impossible. Now, this is absurd. The fact is copyright law already does treat musical recordings very differently, and it treats music, musical scores, differently in some ways, too. So distinctions are certainly possible. Why do they want us to believe that this is impossible? It's so that we will fail to consider all the options. Once we accept the idea that copyright law has to be uniform, the next thing they do is they point to some narrow area and say, in this area, without this much copyright power, we think that some of the works won't get written. Well, supposing that were true, a rational response would be, why should we let that tail wag the dog? But people don't usually have their act together enough to notice that that's the proper response. In any case, there's no reason why we should pay the same price for everything we buy. In fact, if we had to pay the same price for everything we buy, the economy would come to a halt. $1,000, to buy a new car for $1,000, that's a great price. To buy a box of milk for $1,000, that's a horrible price. Prices have to be different. And it makes sense, if we're going to pay a price in freedom to encourage the production of certain works, we should adjust how much freedom we pay according to what is in our interest for any given area. But the areas I distinguish are not based on media. That's the first thing people think of. How should you treat books? How should you treat video? How should you treat sound recording? These are differences in media. But I think the relevant differences are not about the medium, but rather about the purpose that the work serves. So I've identified three different categories of works. Rather broad categories. One category is functional works, works of practical use, works that you use to do some kind of job. The second category is works that say what somebody thinks. Their purpose for society is to inform you what certain people thought, believe in, saw, whatever. And the third category is works of art or entertainment. That is, works whose purpose for society is the sensation of using them. And I'll argue that these three categories of works should be treated differently in order to support the use that these works have. Now, one way that we should make copyright less is in the area of length. Copyright lasts far too long, and in fact, in most countries, the publication cycle of a book is, or any other work, is getting shorter and shorter. For instance, for books in the US, most books are remaindered, that is, sent to somebody who's going to sell them off cheap, within 2 years, and unavailable within three. This compression of the time scale for most books is happening at the same time where they're saying, we need longer and longer copyright for the others. It's ridiculous. Clearly 10-year copyright, 10 years starting from the date of publication, that is enough. So I would suggest shortening copyright as a first estimate to 10 years. And then we can see how things go and maybe shorten it some more. This is 10 years after publication, so that if someone writes a manuscript and doesn't find a publisher and keeps looking for 20 years, I see no problem with having that have its 10 years of copyright once it is published. Maybe the author has become famous in that time and can now publish the old manuscripts. there's no harm in copyright continuing while the book is not available to anyone yet anyway. Now, I once suggested this idea sitting on a panel with authors, and I thought that they might argue with me. And the award-winning author sitting next to me did argue with me. He said, 10 years? That's intolerable. Anything more than 5 years is no good. You see, some of his books were out of print. And his contract had the usual clause that said if the publisher lets the book go out of print, then the contract is canceled and the author now gets the rights back. And he wanted to get the rights back so he could distribute some copies to people. He wanted people to be able to read his books. And the publisher was doing something that publishers often do, mistreating the author. The publisher had let the book go out of print but was refusing to admit this. They have regular policies where they just lie to authors and see, and they're essentially saying, see if you can get a lawyer and make us comply, huh? And if the author gets a lawyer and does enough stuff, eventually they go along. Now, quite why they cared when the book was out of print anyway, I don't know. But they do this kind of thing. And he had recognized that more than 5-year copyright was very unlikely to do him any good, but would prevent the publisher from screwing him. Now, you may have expected, as I expected at that moment, that the authors, the artists, are always going to be in favor of more and longer copyright. But the fact is they're starting to realize that it doesn't serve them. Because the same publishers that are the ones who mainly demand increased copyright power are the ones who are mistreating the authors. They have some superstars, the authors or artists, whatever field it is, they have some superstars who really do benefit from copyright. And so whenever there are congressional hearings, they will bring along some famous musician or author to say, yes, we want more copyright. But that's not what's good for most authors or most musicians or most whatever. So that's what I suggest for the time scale. Shorten it. You know, 10 years is clearly more than enough. So let's shorten it to that point. And maybe we can then try shortening it a little more after that and see what happens. The other issue is how broad should copyright be? What kinds of uses should copyright restrict? And there, I think these three categories of works make a big difference. For functional, practical works, my conclusion is they should all be free. In the same sense that software should be free. The user should be free to use them, to change them, to redistribute copies, and to publish modified versions, including commercially. As long as it's useful to have things published commercially, as long as that's helpful in making them available, people got to be free to publish commercially their modified versions so that those will be fully available too. Now, functional, practical works include software. They include manuals for software, and more generally, any educational materials, things that you use to study. They include reference works, such as, for example, dictionaries and encyclopedias. Functional works include programs. They include manuals for programs, but more generally also any educational materials, things that you use to study. They also include reference works, for example, dictionaries and encyclopedias. And they include recipes. Recipes are a very interesting case because people who cook are accustomed to studying, changing, redistributing, and distributing modified versions of recipes. They do this all the time. So this is a very good, a good and old example of how important it is to be, to have these freedoms for functional works. However, I wouldn't reach the same conclusion about the second category of works, the works that whose purpose is to say what certain people think or believe or saw. Now, these include books like memoirs. They include essays of opinion. They include scientific papers, which, after all, report what certain scientists saw when they did certain things. They include offers to buy or sell and catalogs of stuff for sale. It can be useful to quote these works, to criticize them or comment on them, but just changing them is misrepresenting the people who said them. And that's not a socially useful thing. There's no reason why society should authorize that. So for these works, the works in the second category, there's no reason why publishing modified versions is to be encouraged ever. So we're left with the question of verbatim copying, exact copying. And for that, there's no particular problem if we say that there's a copyright system that covers commercial copying. And thus, the freedom that individuals have is the freedom to distribute exact copies non-commercially. That's the minimum freedom that people always must have. Because only a police state intruding into people's lives in an offensive way can possibly prevent that. Once people have that freedom, we get copyright that's an industrial regulation once again. The change from the printing press to the computer network changed copyright. Instead of being a restriction on publishers that benefits authors and encourages authors, it became a restriction on the public wielded by the publishers. But the general freedom to redistribute exact copies of any published work reverses that change. Then copyright no longer weighs on the general reading, listening, whatever public, and once again becomes the industrial regulation that it should be. So this solution is a very good one for these works. And in fact, right now, there is a strong movement for freedom to redistribute scientific papers. This is an especially flagrant abuse. A few decades ago, the scientific journals and their publishers were the only way to disseminate scientific information. They were doing something useful and absolutely necessary. Today, the same journal publishers have become parasites, using the power of their position to obstruct the dissemination of scientific information. And their power to do harm is based on copyright law. So really what governments ought to do is just amend copyright law to put an end to this. But they've worked themselves into such a fix that they now find it hard to do that. So instead, people are pushing on it in other ways. For instance, the National Institutes of Health in the U.S., which funds a lot of medical research, is now proposing a requirement that all the research that they fund, that all the papers produced by that research have to go in a server where they're open to the public and people are free to copy them. Verbatim copying only, of course. And so we're seeing a move in that direction. Now, the compromise copyright system I'm proposing, which would liberate verbatim exact copying that is non-commercial, but would still cover commercial use, would provide income in the same way to the authors of this category of works in the same way that the present copyright system does, more or less. For the first category, for the functional works, I'm saying that they should all be free, which means that these artificial restrictions and incentives should go away. Now, you might worry if that happens, would people still be motivated to produce these works? 20 years ago, I didn't know the answer. In fact, nobody knew the answer. But the free software movement has led the way in showing the answer. We've shown the answer is yes. There are some million people developing, contributing to free software. There is a tremendous range of free software available now. The free software directory contains about 3,500 free software packages, and our clerk is still adding them as fast as she possibly can, because there are many others yet to be listed. And then if we look at other kinds of functional, useful works, well, about 5 years ago, I started saying to people that there ought to be a free encyclopedia. And I was saying, if people urge school teachers to join in writing articles, I think we could have a good free encyclopedia in 10 or 20 years. Well, I was really surprised how fast this happened. Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia, is the biggest encyclopedia in history, and now people say the best as well. Nothing can compete with it. This was done... This was done in just a few years. And there are now people starting to write free textbooks and develop free entire educational curricula. So we've demonstrated that for the first category, we don't desperately need the kind of artificial incentive that we can only get by sabotaging our use of these works. So let's remove the restraints. Let's make these practical works available for full use. I can't say the same thing about the second category of works, because I don't know. So I'm proposing a compromise copyright system that will continue to provide more or less an income for the authors, more or less as it does now. For the third category of works, the artistic and aesthetic works, and the entertaining works, the issue of modified versions is a subtle one. And I've continued thinking about it over the past few years. You see, on the one hand, there's the argument that a work can have a certain integrity and that modifying it can destroy the integrity. And it certainly can sometimes happen. On the other hand, modifying these works can be quite a contribution to art. Consider, first of all, the folk process, where a sequence of various musicians or storytellers or whatever will transform a work step by step and produce something that is very rich. Consider, on the other hand, if we want to look at named artists, consider Shakespeare. Shakespeare got the stories for some of his plays from other plays. And if today's copyright law had been in effect then, his plays would have been illegal. He would never have been able to produce them. And, of course, the copyright holder would have said that Shakespeare was just trying to make a cheap ripoff, and that this would have no value. Because Shakespeare was able to produce these plays and they were then published, we can say that that's not true. We can say that they are masterpieces. But if Shakespeare had been blocked from producing these plays, if we had never seen them, we'd have no way to judge for ourselves. And we probably would believe the aggrieved copyright holder who was saying that Shakespeare was just trying to rip them off. So modifying art is very useful. It's a contribution to art. But it's not absolutely essential that you be free to modify a certain piece of art today. If you're using something in your daily life, you must be free to modify it today. Just as you must be free to take out the furniture in your house and put in other furniture today. It shouldn't be forced on you. But you don't use art in the same way that you use software or recipes or encyclopedias. You don't use them to get things done today. You look at them and you see what they say to you. So while this is a contribution to art, it's not urgent. So it's okay if there's a certain amount of time before people are allowed to publish modified versions. We don't want that time to be too long. We don't want that time to be a century, because then it cuts into the progress of culture. But if it were 10 years or something on that order, it would not be a disaster for culture's progress. One can wait 10 years to do a thing like that. One shouldn't have to wait 10 years using a program that's no good for you. But to wait 10 years before you do a certain work of art is not horrible. Or wait 10 years before you publish it is not horrible. Art will still progress. So we can have a compromise copyright system for these works also, where for 10 years, commercial use and including modified versions is covered by copyright and requires permission. But everyone is free to non-commercially distribute verbatim copies of these as any published work. So that's the compromise copyright system that I'm proposing. And if we were to switch to this system, I'm confident we would see no important decrease in the development of our culture. And we would see we would remove the threat of the war on copying, which in the name of the artists and authors is being waged to improve publishers' profits at the cost of our freedom. Now, one consequence of this would be that music sharing on the internet would be legal. Music sharing on the internet must be legal. It is so convenient and so useful for so many people that it's an outrage to interfere with it. People sometimes ask whether this would hurt the musicians. Well, I explained to you how book publishers mistreat authors. The record companies do something even worse to the musicians. When I buy a commercial CD, I'm generally ashamed because I know that chances are it does not support the musicians. It's true that the contract says that every time a CD is sold, a certain part of the price is nominally the royalty that goes to the musicians. But the fact is, in most cases, they never see it. The reason is that the production costs and the publicity costs are treated as an advance to the musicians. They are labeled this way fictitiously because the musicians never got that money. But they're treated as if they had been an advance. And therefore, when you buy the CD, the maybe €1 worth of money that's nominally the musician's royalties really just goes from one account in the record company to another account in the record company, and the musicians will never get it. even musicians who have been quite successful for a while say things like, I never saw a record company statement that didn't say I owed the company money. A record essentially has to go platinum nowadays before the musicians get any money from it. So what do the musicians get from their record contracts? What they get is publicity. And that does count for something. It's not nothing. It means more people will go to their concerts. And their concerts are the only way they make money. That's all they can live off of. So yes, the record contract is useful for them. It means they can have bigger concerts. But that's not the only way to give them publicity. Music sharing on the internet is a much better way to give them publicity. It's just as good for them, and it's much better for society. It's better in two ways. First of all, because music sharing is good for music listeners, and second, because it's a healthier way to publicize music. It's not possible, it's not so much under the control of hype. I'm just an amateur musician, and I respect the talents of better musicians. But I do not want a music industry. I don't want music to be made in factories. And that's what these record companies are. They are music factories. They bring in carloads of hype, and they squeeze it into something that they call music. And that's what they try to feed to us. Let's get rid of the hype industrial complex. Let music be publicized by music lovers and tried by music lovers and produced by artists, not factories. So, because of these things, if we legalize music sharing, that won't hurt most musicians. But there are a few exceptions. There are a few musicians who really would make less. Mostly they are the superstars. You see, if a musician is an established superstar and has produced the 5 or 7 records required by the contract, at that point the contract's over. Then that musician can renegotiate, can negotiate a new contract with some other company, and has the clout to get a contract that is not exploitative. And those superstars, therefore, really do get a share of the money if you buy their CD. But they're rich anyway. So it's no social problem if they get somewhat less. So, in general, music will be healthier and musicians will be no worse off, except for the rich handful who can afford to be somewhat less rich. We should legalize music sharing right away. However, people might want to do more than that to support musicians better than we do now. I have 2 ideas for ways to support music better than now. One is through a kind of tax. Now, in some countries there are taxes on blank media that can be used for copying music. A system like this could be a good thing if it becomes the way to support the musicians. And here's how to do it. First of all, you collect a tax on these media, or you collect a tax on internet connectivity. And then, second, you distribute this money entirely to the artists, which means players and composers, whoever participated in making the music creatively. And third, you do this on the basis of some kind of statistical sampling to determine popularity, not based on counting record sales, because that leaves out the musicians who are not getting record contracts. The record companies have to be removed from this system. Fourth, you don't do this in linear proportion to popularity. Because if you do it in linear proportion to popularity, the superstars will get a large fraction. You want it to be a well-defined system with no room for arbitrary decisions. but not linear. Instead, I propose something more or less like a square root function, where as the popularity keeps increasing, it still goes up, but not so fast. That way, if the shares are calculated for each musician that way, the super, you know, more popular musicians will still get more, but they won't get so much more. They won't dwarf the amount. They won't suck away the money that could have supported more musicians. This way we can improve the number of musicians who can be supported at an adequate level by a given amount of tax money. And of course, the musicians that hardly anyone listens to will still get hardly any money, which is fair. And fifth, once people who are doing the copying are generally supporting the musicians, even the excuse to forbid copying disappears. It's not a really valid reason to forbid copying, but it's what they use as the excuse. So let's take away the excuse. When everybody who copies music is supporting the musicians, what's to criticize? This is one approach, and it doesn't necessarily have to be limited to music. Maybe it can be extended to some things, some other things. The other approach is voluntary contribution. If you have downloaded some music or a book or whatever, and you like it, you might feel, I'd like to send some money to these people. I haven't supported them. I'd like to. But it's hard to do that. Right now, you have to use a credit card. And it's not anonymous either. You know, records are being kept. And in the U.S., at least, these records are totally available to the police. They can just go and look at anything. Civil liberties have been terribly attacked in the U.S. In Europe, there are privacy laws that to some extent protect this, but it's still being recorded. And it's not convenient. Now, imagine that every time you play a song or read an e-book or watch a video, a box appears that says, click here to send 5 kroner. To the artists. Now, that's such a small amount of money. Why wouldn't you send it sometimes, right? You'd hardly even hesitate. You could easily, you know, once a month, send 5 kroner to some artist whose music you were listening to or whose book you were reading. You'd never even notice. Of course, some people are poor and they might really have to worry about 5 kroner. Well, they won't send money, and that's good. There's no need to squeeze it out of them. You, who can afford it, will pay. Now, if we consider music, then I can say confidently that 5 kroner is, of this 5 kroner payment will be 5 kroner more than most musicians get if you buy their CD. At the same time, it's a lot less than the price of a CD. So we're talking about a much more efficient system to support musicians. I read that in the US, the average person spent $17 or so on recorded music per year. And this is about the price of one CD. And of that, we can estimate on the average 4% goes to musicians, which is about $1 less. And most of that's going to the superstars. So if people didn't have to pay that, but every so often they could send $1, well, suppose 6 times a year they sent $1 to a band. Well, that means $6 going to musicians. That's a lot more. And it means the listener's only paying $6, a lot less. Much better support for musicians. And instead of seeing nasty, vicious propaganda campaigns telling people that it's wrong to share, that if you share, you're a pirate, we'll imprison you, we'll attack you, don't ever share. Instead, and this goes against human nature, which is to help your friends. Instead, we could have a campaign that works with human nature, saying, did you send a dollar to a band this month? If you're reading a book on your computer, how about sending a dollar to the author? And there will be a box right there on the side all the time saying, click here to send a dollar to the author. You can ignore it, but you'll keep seeing it. I'm sure it's obvious that a lot of people will send this money. It's a good system for supporting all sorts of creativity. So, what's the situation in Norway? The European Union adopted a copyright directive a couple of years ago, which is similar to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. It says that it's forbidden to distribute any kind of product or information that helps people bypass the imposed restrictions, the digital restrictions management in the players for ebooks, for fake CDs and whatever, and DVDs. And the only exception allowed is if it has another substantial commercial use. Now, this is interesting because it says that because they have explicitly subordinated your freedom to business. They don't care if something has a significant use for the sake of a significant social use, or a significant ethical use, or a significant use for the sake of people's freedom. Those are explicitly given no importance in this directive. The only kind of other use that has any significance is commercial significance, commercial use. So this directive says, business matters, your freedom does not. And it's clear that if this directive is implemented in Norway, then what Jón Johansson did for us all would be prohibited. And I saw a description. Someone was kind enough to translate for me one paragraph of the Norwegian government's proposal. And it said that making, for instance, a free program to decode the movie on a DVD would still be legal as long as it's done in the private sphere. And in the private sphere appears to mean that if you write the program yourself, you can use it yourself. But you couldn't distribute it to anyone, and no one else could distribute it to you. So essentially, this tiny remnant of our freedom is what they're leaving you. So little that it's obvious hardly anyone could ever manage to make use of it. In fact,
actually, it's personal and your friends and family, close family, so it's a bit more.
I see. So, okay, so you and your friends could work together on developing this program and use it. But it could never be available beyond that. So this is ridiculous. And it's a fact that they are talking about prohibiting what DVD Young did for us. And you've got to bring that home to them hard. Norway should veto that directive. There's no reason to impose it. All it does is take away the freedom of the citizens. There is no need for it, no legitimate purpose for it. This is meddling in the country's internal affairs, and for the sake of it, of the sovereignty and independence of the country, if for nothing else, it should be resisted. Now, I think there could be a way to implement the directive that would be less harmful. The directive should be vetoed entirely. I think that there is a way to implement it that avoids the absolute worst part. It's still bad. There's still no reason to even consider this thing. But what could be done is to say that if a free software package does exactly the same things that an authorized player does, then it is legitimate. Because it doesn't really circumvent anything. If it does exactly what the authorized player does, then this program as such will not circumvent anything. Its only relevance to circumvention is that someone might modify it. So does that count? This is the question. The law to implement the directive could be written in such a way that as long as the program as it is does not circumvent, it is lawful. And at least this would make it possible to watch the film on a DVD with free software if you could watch it with proprietary software. The free software that would play the DVD in the same way as the authorized player could be distributed openly and lawfully. So this would at least prevent the directive from being a gunshot to the heart of free software. It would still be an unjust restriction on the freedom of everybody in the country. So the directive really should be vetoed. But if they don't have the courage to do what's fully right for the citizens, they could at least preserve an opening for free software. Now, another EU directive which was adopted earlier this year is the, quote, intellectual property, unquote, enforcement directive. It's a very bad directive since it was inspired by the confusion of the term, quote, intellectual property, unquote. It became fashionable 10 years ago to stop talking about copyright, and stop talking about patents, and stop talking about trademarks, and just say intellectual property, no matter which one you're talking about. This is like, well, no longer say Norway, no longer say Spain, no longer say Germany, no longer say France, just say Europe, whichever one it was. So instead of saying Paris is the capital of France, I'd say Paris is the capital of Europe. And I would say, instead of pasta comes from Italy, I'd say pasta comes from Europe. And, you can imagine if people never said the names of individual countries and just...
I'm changing tapes.
Oh, good. Thanks.